Państwu, witam Państwa bardzo serdecznie na kolej.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to yet another lecture of the 27th Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow.
Polish, and then I say a few words in English, and we'll start. Więc witam Państwa bardzo serdecznie.
So once again, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I have two messages for you. I have a bad message. I have a fantastic message. The bad message is that the ambassador of Israel, Ms. Anna Azari, broke her leg. The fantastic message is that she is going to be substituted by
perfectly. Now I'm approaching you.
Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, the deputy ambassador is here with us. Her name is not Anna Azari. Her name is Ruth Cohen. And she's the one who's going to spend this time with you, an hour and a half, and she will speak on behalf of Anna Azari. And I'm sure she will add much more on her own, on her behalf. As Deputy Ambassador, speaks Polish, ladies and gentlemen. And we've just seen how well she speaks Polish. And you will have an opportunity to ask questions in Polish. This will be an excellent chance for her to work on her Polish, so it can be even better.
This is the unbelievable, but this is the seventh day of a Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow, the 27th edition of a Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow. So I have two news for you. Let's say not very bad news, could be always worse, and fantastic news. The first news is that Ambassador of Israel, Mrs. Anna Azari, for unknown reason, broken her leg. So she couldn't come. Fantastic news is that she will be replaced, even more than replaced, by Vice Ambassador of Israel in Poland, Mrs. Ruth Cohen, very famous family and rabbi in Yerushalayim, in Israel, wherever you go, you always find somewhere Cohen's people, you know, and Cohen is... So, Mrs. Ambassador will share with you what Anna Azari wanted to share with you, and knowing Mrs. Cohen, I know that she will add a lot from her mind, from her heart, so I'm sure that you will spend a fantastic 2, 3, maybe 5 hours over here. Please, I want to encourage you, ask her questions in English, in Polish, in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in Japan, in whatever. She knows everything. She's very modest. She's very modest. So it's a great, great pleasure. It's a great, great pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. Mrs. Ruth Cohen, Vice Ambassador of Israel in Poland.
No, you have to sit down.
Oh, yeah, sure. You have a microphone over here.
Can I take it?
Yeah, sure. It's for you. Absolutely.
Okay. Dzień dobry wszystkim.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Unfortunately, my Polish is not good enough to deliver this lecture in Polish, so I apologize, but I will be speaking English, and I hope that it will be an interesting lecture, nevertheless.
I think this guy really gets a round of applause. This festival is his life project, and I really encourage you to give him a round of applause to Ms. Mako. Thank you. And thank you always for having us and opening your home to us. Thank you very much. How many of you have been in Jerusalem? Oh, great, 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 great. I'm a fourth generation Jerusalemite, so Jerusalem is in my heart and in my blood. And I don't know if you guys know, it's like the contest between Warsaw and Krakow. You either love Jerusalem or you totally hate it. I love Jerusalem, so don't try to say a bad word about Jerusalem. We'll start with something that really epitomes my view of Jerusalem. It's a very short film, and then we go on. You can dance if you want. Great. We're going to talk today, shortly, about the concept of Jerusalem, a little bit about the heavenly Jerusalem, and a little bit about the physical Jerusalem. As you all probably know, there are two Jerusalems to many of us in the world. And I would like to start with this map. Anybody knows this map? This is the Bunting's map from 15, some say 85, some say 1581. It doesn't matter. It's the end of 16th century. It was painted by a German priest who was a theologist and a cartographist. And you can see where Jerusalem is in the middle, while the continents are around it in a shape of a clubber. And he called it die ganze Welt in einem Kleberblatt, welches ist die Stadt Hannover meines Leben Vaterlandes. He is looking at Jerusalem in the middle of the world, but also looking for Hannover, the place where he was born. So this is to give you the concept of how Jerusalem was perceived throughout the history by different people. You can give it to me, it will be easier for us, both of us, thank you. So if we look at Jerusalem, at Jewish life in Jerusalem, and probably many of you know the Bible, Jewish life in Jerusalem started about 3,000 years ago at the mid of the 1600s BC. And throughout the history in the Bible, we have the Kingdom of David. That was the first time, actually, it was not just spread settlement in Jerusalem, but actual a capital, the choice of Jerusalem as a capital of the kingdom. That's actually the first time Jerusalem has become a core place for the Jewish people. And from that point on, it has its own status, and it has a place in Jewish history that kept throughout all these thousands of years, even when Jews were not settled in Jerusalem. Actually, Jews were settled in Jerusalem throughout history, but when it did not exist as a capital of a people, when Jews were spread all over the world in the diaspora. It started at 70 after Christ, with the Roman Empire taking over the land of Israel. They gave Jerusalem a name. They replaced the name Jerusalem. Anybody knows what's the names they gave it? Ilia Capitolina. Ilia Capitolina means the capital. But their goal was to totally erase any Jewish connection to the city. They understood the role of Jerusalem as a core, as a place to look at, as a place of gathering, as a place that gathered the Jewish people together. And the Romans' interest was to simply erase any Jewish connection between Jerusalem and the people. And in 132, after the Bar Kokhba mutiny and the very bad defeat of this mutiny, the rest of the population, only a few stayed, was expelled and spread all over the world. And the remains of the Holy Temple were taken to Rome. Until now, you can see in Rome the old gate and the menorah from the old temple. The second temple of the Romans took. So the expulsion took us away from Jerusalem physically, but never disconnected Jews from. How do you? Just let's do it like this. And this is a bit of a bad slide, but it tries to give you the understanding of the continuity of rulers in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was always in the focus, in the middle of interest of kingdoms, of kings, of rulers, and not only Jerusalem, but the land of Israel. There is a whole historic explanation for it because of the geographic and political place of Israel and especially Jerusalem in our region. It was in the middle of a very important commercial route from north to south and also from east to west and to the exit to the Mediterranean. So it was a core place, but I want to skip it and not talk about the geopolitics. I want you to take a look at the dynasties after the expulsion of Jews from the land of Israel. So Romans ruled afterwards, the Byzantines was the kingdom that Rome became after acquiring Christianity. And then you can see that every big empire in our region took over the land of Israel and established some kind of presence in Jerusalem all the way to 1948. We will talk about some of the stages that created the current situation in Jerusalem in order to understand the physical part of our situation today. Okay, so if we look at the history around since the expulsion of Jews, have any of you been in a Jewish wedding?
Yes.
Great. What does the groom say before he breaks the cup? You know, the breaking of the cup in a wedding?
This is Orthodox wedding.
Yes.
Orthodox wedding.
It's okay, I will say it for you. Since, by the way, my son got married 2 weeks ago, so I know it by heart. Every groom in a Jewish wedding will say, "Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, tishkach yemini, tidbak lashoni lechiki im lo eskerechi." Meaning, if I forget you, Jerusalem, just think, it's a very important moment of a person. He's getting married. He's saying his vows to the wife, to the person who will accompany him for his life. He remembers Jerusalem. "If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand be forgotten. May my tongue get stuck to my mouth if I will not remember you." This is a sentence every groom says in every wedding. And this tells you how throughout history, from ancient times until today, we have Jerusalem at the core of our heart. Even though for 2,000 years, Jews were not in Jerusalem and Most of them were spread around the world, and the dream of Jerusalem, Beshana Haba Birushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, is something we say in every Pesach, Passover Seder. At the end of the Passover Seder, you have to finish it with Beshana Haba Birushalayim, meaning next year in Jerusalem. We will do it next year in Jerusalem. The dream, the aspiration, the ideology for Jerusalem was always there from the moment the Jews were spread around the world by the Romans until we established our country. Okay, the one point that I would like to talk about here is that even though most of the Jews were expelled by Romans, there are very good archaeological and historical testimonies that there was a Jewish settlement in the land of Israel and also in Jerusalem, first under the Roman Empire and then under the other empires who came afterwards. And unfortunately, there is today a bit of a questioning of this continuity, but history and historical facts and archaeological facts tell us the story on contrary. The Jews kept continuity and a presence in Jerusalem from ancient times until today. I'm doing a fast forward, like we're jumping. We went into a time machine and we jumped into the 19th century, and in a census done in the 19th century in Jerusalem by the Ottoman Empire, the empire that later became Turkey of today, ruled for over 400 years in the land of Israel. It was called the Southern Pecha, and Jerusalem was the center capital of this region in the Ottoman Empire. By the way, the Ottomans are the ones who rebuilt the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. If you are going to Jerusalem, to the old city today, and you look at the walls that surround the old city of Jerusalem, these walls were built by the Ottomans. It's not from ancient times. There are part of it that archaeologists say that are from the times of the first temple, some of them from the second temple, but the walls were renovated and built again by the Ottomans. So the Ottomans ruled in the land of Israel and in Jerusalem until 1917, until the Brits came in. But in 1884, you can see the population in the old Jerusalem inside the walls. There was still no settlement outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. And you can see already a majority of Jews in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was always the land to aspire to. My great-great-grandmother and my grandfather immigrated from abroad to Jerusalem in the mid of the 19th century, the dream to live in Jerusalem. And that's what brought them there. So in 1922, already after the British mandate took over, you can see already the development of the population. Can you move? No, then go back one, sorry. I just want to say one word about the population from 1922 to 1946. The Brits took over the land of Israel in 1917, defeating the Ottoman Empire. And when they got from what today is the United Nations, the mandate to rule the land of Israel, they have decided to put an effort in increasing the Jewish population in the land of Israel. And these efforts are showing already in the numbers we can see in this slide. In 1922, we already have 31,000, and in 31, not even 10 years after, it's almost double the number. And of course, in 46, right after the war, it's almost 100,000 people in Jerusalem itself. After talking a bit about history, I would like to go back to heavenly Jerusalem, to the concept of Jerusalem in our dreams, in our philosophy, in our theology. Do you know what a Jerusalem syndrome is? Anybody knows what Jerusalem syndrome is? What is Jerusalem syndrome? It's when people are so fascinated with Jerusalem, they get crazy. So there are people who really come to Jerusalem, get high without taking any chemicals, and finally find themselves in a mental hospital. So Jerusalem can do you that. And the heavenly Jerusalem is a concept in many scripts, in many poems, in literature, of course. There are wonderful stories. Famous Shai Agnon wrote a couple of his stories that you can feel you're walking in the streets of Jerusalem. Shai Agnon, by the way, is an Israeli writer who won the first Nobel laureate Israeli writer. Thank you. This map of Jerusalem from the Middle Ages, you can see the Jerusalem is in the middle, but you can also see very clearly the Christian crusaders entering the city, taking over the holy land of Jerusalem. So this is in a Flemish unknown artist, as it says, but I think it's really pretty, the way it centralizes and puts Christianity in Jerusalem without mentioning there are other people there. This map is from England, from the beginning of 14th century. Actually, it's a bit upside down here because of the slide. This should be up, and that's where heaven is. The small triangular point is where heaven is by the map, and Jerusalem, of course, is in the center. You can see the middle is a little bit enlarged on the left corner, and this is the core, the holy part, and it looks up to heaven, Jerusalem as a place that is close to heaven. Here you can, you can put this. This one. Yeah. This, we were talking about prayers to Jerusalem, so something nice to break my talking. Just put it.
Studio Godcast.
So it's next year in Jerusalem, as I said. Good. So when we look at Jerusalem in the eyes of others, does anybody have a feeling about Jerusalem? When I say the word Jerusalem, what do you think about? Anybody wants to share? Please, be with me. I'm boring myself. Anybody has a thought? Yeah.
The first time I was in Jerusalem, I studied in the Hebrew school. In Bogota, Colombia. And the first time I arrived, I arrived to Israel when I was 17. I was crying, and I didn't know why I was crying in Jerusalem. And because all my school and my life is Jerusalem, is the place. It's not Tel Aviv. It's Jerusalem.
Thank you. Anybody else has feelings about Jerusalem? I have a lot of feelings about Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was always an inspiration, and also in the eyes of other people. By the way, Częstochowa is here because Ambassador told me a story, an interesting story. She met a few people from Częstochowa, is a city in Poland, for whoever is not from Poland. Częstochowa is a holy city. It has the Jasna Góra, a very important monastery with a very holy image of Maria and Jesus, and this is a place where Poles pilgrimage every August. They go there by foot, they go as a holy place. And Ambassador met people in Częstochowa, Polish people, who told her they were disappointed with Jerusalem. Because they had the image of Częstochowa in their eyes, you know, everything is a big monastery. Jerusalem is a holy place in your dreams, but also a place where people live. So this is just an anecdote to tell you how people see it in their dreams, and when they come, sometimes there is a little bit of a reality check. This is a city with a little bit dirt on the streets, people walking, not everybody is religious. You know, when I ask Polish people what is an Israeli for you, many of them will tell me the Hasidic Jew with the kapota on their head. Well, most of us are looking like this. So this is the big reality check. So this is from 1400, an Italian, famous Italian artist, and this is the entrance to the gates of Jerusalem. Doesn't look like it at all. Just see the dream, you know. They have the image of Rome or maybe Florence in their brain, and they project it on Jerusalem, so Jerusalem looked like this. When you look at photos of Jerusalem from that era, it's totally wreck, because the Romans managed to ruin everything, and every war that came afterwards created damage, additional damage, and nothing was really built until the Ottomans started to rebuild Jerusalem. Again, an Italian artist. Again, Jerusalem looks like something in Rome or in the mountains in Italy. And now we are doing a fast forward to the 19th century. The 19th century in Europe was a century of awakeness of national feelings, national identities, national feelings, and also the land of Israel has become a place where every nation wanted a peace, especially in Jerusalem. If you walk in Jerusalem, in several parts of Jerusalem, you could identify, for instance, right outside the walls, there is a hill with a Scottish church. And then a little bit, a kilometer from there is the Russian court with a Russian church. And you go a little bit further, you have a British monastery. If you walk around Jerusalem, not only in the old city, the outcome of this race in the 19th century is visible. You could see nations from all over the world trying to get a piece of the holy place. And this race created a new development in Jerusalem, including Jews leaving the old city inside the walls and starting to live outside the walls. The first neighborhood outside the walls, Mishkenot Sha'ananim, is still visible and currently an active music and culture center. It's a long, long building. The first building that was built outside the walls, right across the Geben Hinnom Valley, which is a huge valley between the old city and another hill on the other side. And fast forward to the 19th century, we're like jumping in history, and we are looking at a very famous guy who, his motto, if you want, it is possible to get it, Im tirzu ein zo agada, it's not a legend, and the Zionist movement. Does anybody know the Zionist movement, where the name comes from? Zion is one of the 77 names of Jerusalem. Anybody knows any other names for Jerusalem except Jerusalem? Jerusalem, Zion. There are 77 names. Not even I know all 77. It's called the beautiful city for the king. It has all kinds of names. But Zion, the aspiration for Zion, the aspiration for Jerusalem, and the aspiration for Jerusalem has become the Zionist movement that in the 19th century, yes? Yeah, Oh, sorry, a typo. Where are you, Grzegorz? A typo. Sorry, I missed it. 1897. Absolutely. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Bravo. That's the birthday of my son. Couldn't be the Zionist. yeah, 1897. I'm sorry. Really, my biggest apology. This was the movement that was created here in this area, by Jews from Galicia, Jews from Russia together. The movement started in this area, and Theodor Herzl was actually the big voice that voiced those aspirations. His book, The Jewish State, was actually the foundation of the scripts of the Zionist movement, the aspiration for a historical homeland. After the first Zionist Congress in Basel, the 1897 Congress, the activists, the leaders of the Zionist movement, walked around the world practically by foot from one leader to another to convince the leaders of the world to help the Jews realize their aspiration for a national home. The first step was the Balfour Declaration, and the Balfour Declaration was written by Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister of the British Empire in 1917. The actual date is 2nd of November 1917. It was presented to the government of Her Majesty, and you can see in the text that what the Balfour Declaration emphasized, and later on it was echoed in official documents by the Commonwealth of the People and by the UN, was the national home for the Jews. Being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Meaning, we want to create a national home for the Jews, but we do not intend to hurt anybody else. Please remember this, because this sentence is also echoed, later on we'll talk about it, in our Declaration of Independence of 1948. So Balfour's declaration was the first step, the first achievement of the Zionist movement, the first step to realize the dream of creating a national home for the Jews. In 1922, but I want to take a step before that. In 1922, the League of the Nations, the Commonwealth of the Nations, has granted Britain, the British Empire, the mandate on the land of Palestine. It was called Palestine, by the way. This is the name the Romans gave the land of Israel. When they expelled the Jews, they called Israel Palestine, and as I said, Jerusalem was Ilia Capitolina. But before that, in 1920, right after the World War I, the Commonwealth of the Nations gathered in Sanremo, Italy, to discuss the outcomes of the First World War I. And there, one of the paragraphs in the decision echoed the Balfour Declaration. This was another confirmation for the aspiration of the Jewish leaders, and then we got the mandate. Within the mandate resolution, the mandate resolution echoes exactly the wordings of the Balfour Declaration. If we look at the text of this resolution, We can see that out of, 20 paragraphs, about six of them talk about a national home for the Jews. It defines the Jewish agency, Hasuchnut HaYehudit, for the Jews among us who probably knows the Sochnut. The Sochnut HaYehudit, the Jewish agency, was already defined as the body that will be the administrative body for the Jewish population in the land of Israel. So it was not just a promise for a home for the Jewish people, it also had practical measures to create all possible infrastructure for this national home for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So when we go back to think why actually the land of Israel, by the way, Herzl at a certain point when he couldn't get any achievements before we got to the Balfour Declaration, he came up with a very interesting plan. He decided, okay, the Jews in Europe, they were persecuted and murdered, and anti-Semitism was here everywhere. Herzl, for you who don't know, was from Austria, and he experienced anti-Semitism in his own life. And he also was a journalist who covered the Dreyfus trial in France. Dreyfus trial was a trial of a Jewish officer in the French army that was falsely accused of betraying France, and who was very badly treated by the French government. And so he thought, okay, we cannot get the national home in Palestine, in the land of Israel. Maybe we should find an alternative. And he came up with the idea to take all the Jews to Uganda. Just think what would have been today if we were in Uganda. But of course, it evoked a big discussion in the Jewish world, especially in the Jewish leadership of the Zionist movement. It was a big no, because the aspiration was for Zion, for the land of Israel, because of the thousands of years of connections between Jews and the land of Israel. So the mandate in 1922 very clearly defines that the mission of the British mandate in the land of Israel is to create the conditions and the infrastructure to build the national home for the Jews. It has clauses about the existing Arab population, not to offend their rights, not to to protect their life and communal life, but the mandate was very clear about building a national home, and of course in Jerusalem. Okay, if you can put the film. Bardzo dziękuję. We'll watch a short animation about the Declaration of Independence.
May 14th, 1948, 4 p.m. Tel Aviv. On a small podium stands a determined Zionist leader before a hastily convened gathering, reading out a proclamation which would change the course of history. This is how the State of Israel was born. First, a bit of background. At the end of World War I, the Allied powers gained control over the Middle East, including the Land of Israel. The League of Nations recognized the historical connection of the Jewish people to their land and granted Great Britain a mandate to help them reconstitute a national home. However, Arab riots and geopolitical considerations led to a series of British restrictions on Jewish development and immigration. Even ships, including displaced children and Holocaust survivors, were sent back to Europe. Jewish resistance grew as well. By 1947, the ball was back in the United Nations court, where a majority of the nations decided on November 29th, after a tense vote, to divide the land into a Jewish and an Arab state. The Jews rejoiced. The local Arab population, well, they launched a war throughout the country. May 15th, 1948 was the date the British mandate officially ended, the date the Jewish state was to be declared, and the date five regular Arab armies planned a coordinated attack to annihilate the newborn state. On May 12th, David Ben-Gurion convened the People's Council. The atmosphere was grave. Moshe Charette reported that the Americans are demanding a postponement of the declaration, or else they would not help Israel against the United Arab invasion. Golda Meir reported that King Abdullah had retracted his original agreement and will join the attack. Military leaders expressed serious doubts about the ability of the small Jewish community to withstand five regular Arab armies equipped with European weaponry. But somehow, after 13 hours of deliberations, Ben-Gurion succeeds in swaying the balance against the American demand. And on Friday, May 14th, in the presence of local Jewish leaders, he declares the establishment of the State of Israel. The proclamation, which was inspired by the American Declaration of Independence, asserted the historical and moral rights of the Jewish people in its historic homeland, and defined Israel as a Jewish democratic state based on equal rights, freedom, and justice. The declaration ended with a call on Jews to return home and extended a hand for peace towards the local Arab population and neighboring Arab countries. The Arab invasion was immediate and lasted for over a year. Close to 50% of Israel's small fighting force were survivors of the Nazi death camps, who vowed never again. One out of every 100 Jews living in Israel died in the fighting. But by the end of the war, the small Jewish state had emerged victorious as an independent nation in its homeland for the first time in 2,000 years.
Okay, we can go home. I love this. I don't know what about you. Do you know, guys, where Ben-Gurion is from, where he was born? Oczywiście. In Płońsk. I'm thinking if it was today, would we be able to build this, to go through what they went through? My feeling is a bit doubtful. I just want to point out on the Declaration of Independence the few issues that we were talking before. The echoing of the decisions and the Balfour Declaration, and in the Declaration of Independence, I'm holding a copy, of course, not the original, God forbid. It says like this: this right, the right to declare independence and declare the State of Israel, was recognized in Balfour Declaration and was confirmed by the mandate from the Commonwealth of the Nations. That's for one. And it refers to the decision by the UN from November 1947. And this decision of the UN has recognized the right of the Jewish people to build its states. And then, on the next paragraph, our leaders are calling within the time of war to all our Arab neighbors, the citizens of the State of Israel and others, to live in peace with us and to take part in building the state and sharing the Commonwealth. And this, the declaration ends with, we extend our hand to peace and good neighborhood, and so on and so forth. But while our leaders were declaring the dependence, the establishment of the State of Israel, five Arab armies have attacked Israel. It was Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, joined by Iraq from the eastern side. It was a year-long war that was really, from time to time, the feeling was that we will be annihilated, but we managed to overcome it, and the State of Israel was established. And by the way, between 48, when we were about 600,000 Jews in the Land of Israel, and 54, do you have any idea how many people we had? Exactly double. In 1954, we were 1.2 million Jews in the land of Israel, which means on top of war and establishing a new country and doing everything from scratch, we got all the immigration, mainly from Europe, but a lot from the Arab countries, because once the state of Israel was established, the Jewish communities in the Arab countries were persecuted. In Iraq, they were hanged in the middle of the streets just to show how the Jews are traitors, and they had to leave their homes. They were expelled from their homes and were brought to the land of Israel with almost nothing, with some of them with the clothes on their bodies, having to leave all their possession, everything they had before in the original countries because of the establishment of the State of Israel. Okay, we're moving now to a bit more complicated area. Are there any lawyers in the crowd? No lawyers. Oh, there are. Oh my God. Can you take a break, go have coffee? Just joking. The UN resolutions are important base and important infrastructure for one, for the existence of the State of Israel, but for also it's part of a lot of challenges and obstacles that the State of Israel has been having since the establishment of the State of Israel and until today. Two interesting facts for you guys. Do you know where Israel established its first embassy outside of Israel? The first embassy outside of Israel was established on the 26th of September, 1948, in Hotel Bristol in Warsaw. So Poland was our first ally in the Western world, then already a communist country. And in 1941, in 1949, Israel was admitted to the UN as a full member, including to our beloved UNESCO, which is convening on Sunday here in Krakow to pass again another decision about Jerusalem as not as a place of any special connection to the Jewish people. So, decision 181, the decision of the partition of the land of Israel, was received by the UN, and I think we have a small film here that will be interesting for you guys, because this is the voting in the UN. And just please note, when the list comes up, note that the list of the nations, just put it. Yeah.
Now, Soviet Union, yes.
Stop it, when Poland comes in. Poland.
Abstain.
No. Did you notice Poland?
Yes. United Kingdom.
A little bit here. So Poland voted yes. Yay.
Abstain. The United States. Yes.
Okay. The Jewish population in the land of Israel went to the streets, danced in the streets all night, and were happy, even though Jerusalem was out of our circle. Because Jerusalem, in Resolution 181, that you just saw it passing, that established the State of Israel, the legitimacy of the State of Israel, took Jerusalem out of the equation. There would be a state for the Jewish people, the State of Israel. There would be a state for the Arab people on the land. But Jerusalem was decided to be an international special status, an international body under the UN auspice. And this was, for us, a very painful decision to accept. But with the aspirations to create the land of Israel, the Jewish leaders, the Zionist leaders, were ready to accept this obstacle. The other side did not accept it. The Arabs broke in a big riot on the day of the declaration of the partition, and actually the War of Independence started already a few days after the partition decision. And at the end of the independence war, the 1948 war, the eastern part of the Jerusalem, the old city, including all the holy places, were captured by Jordan. Israel was left with only the western part. I remember as a little child, my mother would take me. There was a very high place on the western part where you could stand on the porch and you could outlook on the old city of Jerusalem, and people were standing there praying for Jerusalem in the middle of the day until 1967. Can you pass? Thank you. You can pass this. Yeah, in 1949, Israel has decided to make Jerusalem its capital, the western part of Jerusalem, and actually until today, no resolution by international body has opposed that or challenged the western part of Jerusalem. The issue on the table is the eastern part of Jerusalem. If anybody has questions, we can talk about it later. And of course, the adoption of the capital by the Knesset, our parliament, exactly at the same time. Okay, this is a little bit of Jerusalem in 1949. This is right after the war, so you can see the damages of the war. You can move forward. Okay, we do fast forward 19 years, move to 1967. 1967 finds the young Jewish state confronting tensions with our neighbors, mainly from 48 to 67. There was no peace. If anybody thinks we skipped it, it's just because of time. We had a lot of tensions, a lot of aggressions from our neighbors. We survived it. 67 is a point because it's a turning point in the history of our country and a very significant turning point in the history of Jerusalem. I'm skipping the other wars because it's a bit too long to talk about. If you'd like, we can talk about it on the questions. So in 1967, Israel was attacked by Egypt and Syria simultaneously, and Israel has sent messages to Jordan not to join the war with the other two countries. Jordan did not listen to us and started bombing Jerusalem from east to the western part of Jerusalem and engaged into the war. On the second day of the war, forces of Israeli IDF simply marched into the eastern part and pushed the Jordanians far away beyond the Jordan River, and Jerusalem was united for the first time under Israeli government. I have to put one thing clear. The access to the holy places that was established by the UN resolutions, the UN 181 and the Balfour and the Sanremo resolution, which said that all religions will have access to the holy places, was banned from Jews between 48 and 67. Jews could not access the holy places in the eastern part of Jerusalem. The first time Jews could pray next to the Wailing Wall freely was after 1967. I love this photo. This is one of the famous photos of the Six-Day War. These are paratroopers next to the Kotel. The guy in the middle, who you see him in the other photo, is a doctor, and it's really nice to see them something like 30, 40 years afterwards. You can move forward. Okay. In 1980, the Knesset of Israel decided to pass a law, a legislation, that unites both parts of Jerusalem and establish it as a one city, a one capital under Israeli law, granting citizenship, Israeli citizenship, to all Arabs living on the eastern part of Jerusalem. The UN Security Council passed Resolution 478, which called Israel not to do it, which challenged the Israeli move, and called all Western countries who have embassies in Jerusalem, even if in the Western part, to pull their embassies from Jerusalem, and all the embassies except for two moved from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, and this is the status until today. By the way, this resolution was passed under Chapter 6 and not Chapter 7. You'd probably hear this here and there, and you'd wonder, what does it mean? In the Charter of the UN, there are separate paragraphs. Paragraph number 6 talks about peace and making sure peace will be brought to all areas, the responsibility of the UN to bringing peace. And Chapter 6 is a level of a recommendation. Chapter 7 is a chapter that gives the UN Security Council the authority to execute also measures that are connected to peacekeeping. Chapter 7 is kept in order to create a mechanism for the UN to confront war situations. So in this case, even though it was a kind of challenge against Israel, it was taken under a chapter that was not challenging the resolution, which means even the UN recognizes, in a way, the legitimacy and the right of Israel to have a capital in Jerusalem. Talking about UNESCO, I will leave it a little bit to the questions if you'd like, but in the end of last year in Turkey, the Heritage Committee, the committee that is responsible for preserving heritage, history and culture, has passed a resolution about the walls of the Old City and Temple Mount, saying that this part of Jerusalem is only Muslim. It calls it only in the Muslim names, in the Arab names, and the Wailing Wall has become El Burak. El Burak was the Arab name that this wall got from the Muslims during the Muslim occupation in the 7th, 8th century, when the Muslims took over the land of Israel from the Christians. So UNESCO, responsible for history, preserving and all this, decided to change history. And it's not even alternative facts, it's totally twisting the reality. So I would like, I would like to thank you and end on a really nice note of current Jerusalem. I hope I didn't bore you to death with all the details. Proszę bardzo.
יועד ציידוף, ואני שוער בקבוצת הפועל קטמון ירושלים.
אני עובד החטב, ואני משחק מגן בלה בפועל קטמון ירושלים.
פועל קטמון קמה מתוך אוהדים כיוזמה חברתית?
יש דברים מיוחדים במועדון הזה.
עובד לימד אותי המון. הדרך שבה הוא תמיד רואה את הצד החיובי בכל דבר, תמיד ידחוף אותך, תמיד יעודד, והוא הכניס פה רוח מדהימה.
אני שומר עליו מאחורה, והוא שומר עליי גם, אותו דבר, אנחנו...
Arabs and Jews playing together in football team, it's not rare. It's not rare.
יש פעילות חברתית עם ילדים בכל אזור בירושלים, מכל מגזר, מכל... וזה רק הולך וגדל, והיום זה כבר הגיע.
And this is my favorite place in Jerusalem.
מזרחי שף במסעדת מחנה יהודה בירושלים. אוכל ישראלי זה כמו קיבוץ גלויות. ירושלמי בשבילי זה המחנה. רוב המנות שאני באמת בונה כולם מתחילות בשוק. אני פשוט מסתובב בשוק ומרחף בתוך עולם שאני לא חושב שאף אחד יכול להיכנס לתוך. אנחנו מסתובבים גם הרבה בעיר העתיקה, באזור שער שכם, ששם יש חומרי גלם שיותר בלעדי, ויש גם בתפריט לא מעט מנות שקיבלנו אותן כמו שיתוף פעולה כזה. יש בעיר הזאת קסם שלא נראה לי אפשר להסביר אותו במילים. מבחינתי יש איזה משהו אחר באוויר שממלא אותי באנרגיות, זה ירושלים בשבילי.
Yeah, energy is Jerusalem for me too. Thank you very much for your time. And if you have any questions, this is the time. You have like 2 minutes. I have a good excuse. Thank you. No questions. Great. Okay. Thank you for coming. Really. Enjoy the festival.
Some kind of private question
for the okay audience. I have to run so